Hello and welcome to the Editor's Podcast for the April 2024 issue of Practical Neurology, the essential guide for neurologists, and a journal packed with clinical wisdom, so much so that we need two editors. So I'm Phil Smith, consultant neurologist in Cardiff, South Wales.
And I'm Garrett Fuller, neurologist in Gloucester, Southwest England, I suppose.
Okay, So Practical Neurology has other podcasts linked to this and every edition. So please subscribe on your favourite platform to ensure that you're notified every time we publish a new podcast. But Garrett, we've got another cracking issue here. 100 pages covering themes from Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, spontaneous intracranial hypotension, drop attacks, riboflavin deficiency. Lots of different types of paper there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously we choose the larger papers for us to focus on in the editor's highlights discussion, and not in any way wanting to diminish the other papers. But it is interesting the way they develop. So in this version, we have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is very clearly a review. It's something we're going to discuss in some detail, but it's very much taking a topic and going with it. And then you've got something like spontaneous intracranial hypotension, another review. But then what's been labeled as a practical guide to drop attacks, which is really someone just trying to solve the problem of drop attacks for us without quite the same bent that we would see in a review. And then you've got other things which are just like a review that we'll be discussing, the riboflavin deficiency paper, which starts with a case and yet provides the same rich data. So we've got these different tiers of paper which produce different types of approach to different problems. So it's really interesting to take a step back and think about the types of paper that we have and what we've got to offer. And I think we've got a very nice spectrum to illustrate the whole range this month.
Indeed. So we're going to kick off then with Ehlers-Danlos syndromes. And this is from the EDS specialist group in London, headed by Fleur Van Dyck. And I should say that Fleur is the practical neurology guest lecturer at the ABN meeting in May. So this is going to be available at that time. The first thing to say, and this is a great paper, of course. I mean, it covers a topic that is so badly needed because we see a lot of people with the label of EDS, but really, how often are we seeing true EDS? And I think the first thing to say is that EDS stands for Ehlers-Danlos syndromes with an S on the end. And Fleur is very insistent that this is not, should not be called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome anymore. It's just too heterogeneous a condition. It's probably a disorder mainly seen in children. And so it's mainly for pediatric neurologists. In fact, unusually for practical neurology in this issue, we have as a case from a 22-month-year-old included in this paper. But there are essentially 14 types now in the 2017 classification. There used to be far fewer, but with the next generation sequencing and so forth, we've got 14 clearly defined types. And I found the interesting things are that 13 of them are rare or very rare, and one of them, which is the hypermobility, is perhaps more common but doesn't have the genetic basis. So neurologists probably need to know two things about, adult neurologists need to know two things about Ehlers-Danlos. The first is they need to know more about the vascular EDS because that is the one that might present with young strokes and other hemorrhagic disorders. But they also need to understand the position of the EDS in terms of the hypermobility spectrum. So just to take the first then, the vascular EDS is a really important condition. It's rare though, one in 90,000. It might present with arterial rupture, including carotico-cavernous fistula and dissection of other vessels. It might present with sigmoid or uterine rupture. And if we come across a case of these, then we would not prescribe antiplatelets except in emergency because of the skin fragility. We would need to advise cardiovascular surveillance, avoiding contact sports, etc., particular care with obstetrics. And the other thing we need to know about is the hypermobility spectrum disorder, which I think is a fairly broad condition. And we are going to see in clinics people with that label of EDS. And one of the things that is stated here is that people with hypermobility EDS have been sort of reclassified into those with fairly tight criteria, quite a rare condition, and the rest go into hypermobility spectrum disorder, but you know, that's a fairly loose diagnosis. So Geraint, what was your take on this paper?
I thought it was very nice. I mean, I think this is one of those reviews where it aims to sort of clarify and shift the thinking a little bit. And I think the very first line that you refer to, that it's Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, is a sort of paradigm shift that we need, where you need to be thinking about this as a group of syndromes with this very, very common and actually relatively less well-defined phenomenon, which actually is really a hypermobility spectrum disorder. And then these very, very well-worked out genetic disorders with, you know, really quite specific and often fairly dramatic associations, which actually make up the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes in their strict form. So I think it is a bit of a paradigm shift, which is always helpful. And I think it's probably going to take some time to filter through, because clearly the clarification of the classification has only relatively recently been introduced. So hopefully that's going to make it easier for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I might have liked to have seen a bit more on the sort of appropriateness of the EDS diagnoses that are out there. I mean, this is often made, this diagnosis, particularly in musculoskeletal clinics. And it's not really touched upon very much, except to say that if people did have a label of hypermobility EDS before 2017, they are allowed to keep the diagnosis, which I thought was an interesting one, that you know, obviously having a diagnosis is very important to people, and they are permitted to keep that, according to the paper, even though the classification has changed.
Yeah, I think it's probably not an unreasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, clearly a lot of people have had a substantial investment in the classification as it was at that time. So it's worth recognizing there's this transition.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing it raises is the value of eponyms, because Ehlers-Danlos, such a great eponym, that is. Ehlers and Danlos, they were dermatologists, it seems, in the early 1900s from France and Denmark, respectively. But, you know, neurologists, we sort of say we don't like eponyms, don't we? We're not supposed to like them, because it sort of rewards the wrong person. It's not necessarily representative. Where are the women? Where are the minorities, etc.? And sometimes you reward the wrong person, like Nazis and so forth. So we don't, not supposed to like them, but everyone loves to say Ehlers-Danlos. And later on in this podcast, we'll love to say Strawn syndrome, I think. So any thoughts on eponyms?
I mean, if you think of some of our biggest diseases, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, it's very hard to get away from these very useful syndromic classifications. And I think without a more specific diagnosis, it's actually quite hard to move away from them. So I think they do a job, but I think you need to know what they mean and their limits. And I think that's the crucial thing if you're going to use the terms.
Yeah, and in the case of Ehlers-Danlos, it's a vast thing, and it's a growing spectrum under that eponymous label. And, you know, it'll probably seem increasingly inappropriate, maybe, as more and more is learnt about these many conditions. So the next paper is our editor's choice, isn't it? Which is, gosh, what a fantastic paper. Spontaneous intracranial hypotension. This is from the giants at Queen's Square, Manjit Mataru and his surgical colleague, Parag Sayal, and several other colleagues have put together their practical neurology version of their recent excellent guideline. So, Geraint, you've been privileged to have a first look at this paper.
It's a lovely paper. And I obviously, this is something which we at one time would have thought was relatively rare outside the setting of a post-lumbar puncture headache. But clearly with the new imaging technology, the MR particularly, it's become increasingly widely recognized. And this is a very nice paper because they've tried to tackle the problem of a relatively common condition that doesn't really have the evidence base for treatment and so on that we would like. And so what they've done is that they've got together a lot of very interested parties and they've tried to work out what the best thing to do, come to a sort of consensus statement. And the consensus has been published as a guideline. And then, as you say, this is our version of that guideline. Now, clearly, this is obviously a first iteration because a lot of the propositions that they give us for treatment and management will be refined and there'll be better trial data for the future. But this gives us a playbook to actually get on with managing these patients. Now, obviously, spontaneous intracranial hypertension is not that uncommon. It's about 4 per 100,000. So that's not an infrequent thing. And a lot of the times you'll be, you know, in a reasonable size unit, you'll be having tens of patients coming through every year. And the first thing to notice is actually it's quite hard to diagnose. I mean, it's a very classical type of headache, tends to be very clearly posturally related, gets better when you lie down, tends to build up as you stand up. And you would imagine that it was quite straightforward to diagnose, yet a fully 40% of patients in one study, the diagnosis was not made by the first neurologist that they met. And they give a long list of the various associations. And aside from the orthostatic headache, which obviously is the key to it, about half the patients feel sick and vomit. A lot of them will have hearing disturbance or dizziness. And then a small number will have more dramatic changes, altered consciousness, movement disorders and so on, some of which we've had as case reports in the practice of neurology in the past. So the diagnosis is really one of those things that you can make if you think about it and you hear the right story. And very frequently it can come on fairly abruptly. They make the point that often if you're seeing the patient after a bit of time has passed, you have to interrogate that first pattern of headache, how it was when it began, because the orthostatic element often fades with time and it becomes a little bit more homogeneous later on and less clearly posturally triggered. They then highlight the fact that the imaging is often extremely helpful. MR with GAD is the best way to try and document it. And they make the point that very often some of the subtler changes can be missed by general radiologists, with neuroradiologists being able to pick up some of the more subtle changes. That they also reassuringly suggest that scanning the whole spine isn't something you have to rush to immediately, but if you do that, it's not going to show you where the leak is, but it's going to tell you which kind of leak it is. And I thought that this was a sort of a significant learning point, is that broadly speaking, there are two patterns of leak. You've got a CSF leak from a dural tear, and then you've got low pressure from a CSF venous fistula. And so those are the two main pathophysiological processes that one has to deal with. Now, fortunately, about a quarter of patients will get better with a bit of bed rest and fluid, and there's some evidence to suggest using caffeine and so on can help. But most patients don't, and the majority of those patients will then be treated with a blind blood patch, which is frequently done by the obstetric anaesthetists, who are very familiar in doing this in the post-LP or post-epidural headaches. And if you do that, then two-thirds of those patients will also get better. And you would imagine that that's actually doing pretty well for a substantial proportion of the patients. What I like about this paper is it then tells you what to do for those tricky patients where things haven't worked. And clearly you can give them another blood patch, that's always an option, but they suggest that this is now a time to investigate things further. And broadly speaking, they suggest that this needs to be done by places where they're sufficiently practiced in doing the procedures, because whilst they may have been relatively commonly done in the past, nowadays doing myelography is actually relatively limited. And there are two different types of myelography that they suggest. There's a hyper-fast CT myelography, or DSA, if you want to try and find evidence for a tear, because that's the speed of the leak. And if that isn't the case, then you can just do to look for a CSF venous fistula with a more conventional myelogram. But experience seems to count in doing those different things. And the point of doing that is that allows either a targeted block of a tear or surgery. And in fact, they illustrate a very nice surgical case where you can actually see a fistula, which is then managed. And broadly speaking, they've rolled these different things into a series of guidelines, and then in essence, something that allows you to follow through where you are with the patients. One of the things that I wasn't aware of, and I think is a really important learning point, is that if you have untreated spontaneous intracranial hypotension, you do have a higher chance of going on to develop superficial siderosis, which presumably is because of a sort of long-term, low-level leak of blood into the spinal fluid. And obviously, superficial siderosis, and we've had a very nice review of that in the past, is a very significant problem, producing vestibular upset and radicular problems. And clearly, avoiding it is a good idea. And so clearly, recognizing and treating this condition earlier will help. So I found it very helpful and very useful. I mean, what's your experience with this condition, Phil? Have you seen many patients with this?
I was pleased to hear that you mentioned that it appears a relatively new condition, because in my training in the 1980s, this was not on the curriculum. If we had a curriculum, that is. I mean, it was at a time when we believed in things like vertebrate insufficiency, etc. But this was not there. And these people must have been coming to clinic and saying, look, the headache gets better when I lie down, it's terrible when I stand up. And we just said, well, that's funny, because that's rather like someone with a lumbar puncture headache, but you haven't had a lumbar puncture and might have stopped there. So this is actually a concept that only really for me came to light in about the 1990s, early 90s, when the MR evidence of it came about. But reading about it, it's a condition first described in 1938, Schelten Brand in Germany described it. So it's been there, but wasn't in the textbooks properly until now. And I mean, it's not always diagnosed when it should be, but in a way, getting to the diagnosis is only part of the problem. Then getting the right treatment, and as you say, in the specialist unit, that's probably where it needs to be. I think a big message I took from this is that we should not be dealing with difficult cases like this, particularly with surgical options, locally too much, because the expertise is there in the centre. I also learned a fair bit about blood patches from this, and I suppose I used to think of a blood patch as being a bit like the inner tube where you stick in that green stuff that seals it and stops the puncture happening. And clearly it's different from that. It's in the epidural space for a start. It's outside of the arachnoid. But apparently what happens is that the blood stimulates an inflammatory reaction around that area rather than it just sort of sealing it off through a clot or something. And so there is a bit more to it in vivo than in the bicycle puncture. Who should do these? Well, it clearly should be obstetric anaesthetist, because neuroradiologists are much more used to puncturing the dura and getting into the CSF space. You really need someone who every day is doing these epidurals where they are well used to getting into the right space, and then injecting a large amount of blood in a sterile way as well, 30, 40 mils. I have seen even more than that for blind patching. The siderosis is really, really important, as are other long-term consequences. Something else I learnt was the risk of a high-pressure headache within a few days of the operation. Perhaps the patients have got used to making more CSF than normal, I don't know, but there's a sort of rebound high-pressure headache after a few days that people need to be aware of. And just how disabling this is, this condition, if allowed to go on, and that does happen for many people, really wrecks lives. And yet it is one of the few conditions in neurology that is curable. So it's the specialist centres that can do it.
Specialist centres, I think actually what we need to see happening now is actually these services being developed up and down the country. Because part of the problem that we have is obviously if you go to Queen Square where they've developed all these things, they have the experience and they've got used to it. But actually, I think this isn't being replicated at all sites. I mean, at all neuroscience centres, for example. So I think, now that we've got a very clear playbook, hopefully it's going to be more straightforward for people to be able to develop the pathway because obviously it requires neuroradiologists, potentially neurosurgeons and so on, to be able to go through that. So I think...
Yeah, and with MDTs so much more done remotely now, these things, it's possible to bring specialists together, even from elsewhere in the country, even from abroad, to give their bit of input as well. So you're absolutely right. I think it should not be a lone neurologist that's doing really quite specialist things here.
Though I think they need to be, and actually I think they capture this in the paper, it's sort of tiered. The vast majority of patients actually... You can get there with a conservative measures or a first blood patch, and I think more blood patches are probably a good idea. But actually getting that process done quickly and delivering that well is going to hopefully prevent the necessity for patients to roll on further down the line.
Yeah. And interesting also, no mention of EDS here, Ehlers-Danlos. And it does seem that this condition is not particularly associated with connective tissue disorders. I heard Mr. Sile saying only about one person in 100 or something seems to have a connective tissue disorder. So it just seems to be a big slice of bad luck getting one of these rather than it being, of course, it's bad luck having EDS and other conditions like that, but that is not closely associated with this condition, which I found of interest.
So we move on to a condition which actually probably was in the textbooks and probably played a larger part in the textbooks when you were training, Phil. Certainly than spontaneous intracranial hypotension, which is drop attacks.
Actually interesting, because in my notes for preparing for this, I've written down it's not in the textbooks, Garrett, because I think actually drop attacks, it is one of those things that's sort of in your head, really. But if you come to write a review on it, as has Mark Manford and his colleagues from Bath and Leeds, they've written a beautiful paper here built on their clinical experience, their long clinical experience. And, you know, it's something that isn't really there in the textbooks, is it? And there's this tiny little footnote to drop attacks and almost dismissive. But, you know, drop attacks go beyond, that we're in the usual first seizure clinic. It's either seizure, syncope or psychogenic. And drop attacks crosses all of these. It's a category of its own. I mean, what these things are isn't even defined out there. And these authors have brought their own definition, which they've had to do, which is in the paper and quite helpful. But
Phil, I think we should take a brief nod. So the first paper that they quote was actually by one of my previous colleagues, David Stevens, and Professor Matthews, the man from Practical Neurology, and his paper, which was Cryptogenic Drop Attacks, an Affliction of Women from the BMJ in 1973. And I think that was really where where it made its entry.
Yeah. So David Stevens, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was a senior registrar at the time, I think. And this paper caused a lot of attention, didn't it? Because it was 30-odd patients, all of whom were women with drop attacks. So the title, as you say, was Middle-Aged Women Have Drop Attacks. Yeah. I'm slightly uncomfortable with that title nowadays, I think. And the interesting in this paper, this review of drop attacks in 2024 doesn't really focus on at all any gender differences. In that paper also, some of the patients were later acquired from a gynecology clinic, interestingly. So I don't know, that David Stevens paper is a landmark, but it sort of set an idea about what drop attacks were being gendered that I don't think necessarily has stood the test of time. So I think that this paper is sort of the magic of practical neurology. I think that this has got something that, this is something that can only be written by people with a lot of expertise in epilepsy, in blackouts, in first seizures, etc. It's something which is badly needed because it fills a gap in our knowledge. But there are numerous causes, and the main cause, I think, to worry about for drop attacks is cardiac syncope, and everyone with a drop attack needs an ECG. But it goes from labyrinthine dysfunction, frailty, dissociative seizures, sometimes epilepsy, that's a rare presentation of epilepsy without learning disability, and then a sort of mishmash of cataplexy, colloid cyst, Chiari, even vertebrobasilar insufficiency gets a mentioned here. So it's a potentially a big paper. I think they've very nicely summarized it into a few pages and made a very practical document that will definitely inform our work in the clinic.
And I think it's a useful conceptual framework because you do see those patients, and you know they're walking along, and they're often fairly insistent that they've gone down and they haven't lost consciousness or lost awareness. And even if someone's with them, there's some uncertainty as to whether they've lost awareness. So it is quite helpful to have that mental category of the drop attacks, because I think it points you very much more on the cardiovascular route. You know, so you're going to be doing more cardiac monitoring, you'll be doing tilt table testing and so on. Because a lot of the time the patients will end up coming through is a query seizure, and having a framework to deal with it, slightly outside our normal range is quite helpful.
Yeah, and actually it ties in quite well, doesn't it, with the tilt table testing paper that we had from Richard Sutton and Paul Cooper, because Paul Cooper actually refereed this paper. You know, that we did toy with the idea maybe of putting the two in the one issue, but we tend not to have themed issues in practical neurology. We want something for everybody in every issue. So we space these two out, but there is a lot of overlap, I think, between the two. So the next paper is called Strawn Syndrome and Riboflavin Deficiency. Strawn, spelt S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N. Grant, you've been having a look at this.
Thank you, Phil. Yeah, I think this is one of those interesting papers where the voice inside your head will change halfway through, because certainly when I first came across this, I was pretty confident it was going to be Strachan syndrome. And for many, many years, I've referred to it as Strachan. And if you start reading this, I'm guessing most of the readers will start off with Strachan syndrome. And it's only when they get to the discussion do they mention that Dr. Henry Strachan pronounced Strawn. So suddenly you feel everything you've read to date is sort of gone slightly wrong, because actually it's all been Strawn all the way through. So, this is a very nice case from Alex Rosser, Caroline Kramatz and James McHugh. And they describe a case in some detail of a young man, 35-year-old, who has really quite a protracted history that develops over some time, a sort of subacute onset of pins and needles, following by blurred vision, loss of hearing. And this is occurring in the context of someone with no particular exposure to toxins, but who's gone to a very strict diet, which is described as a vegan-style diet. And they mention, obviously, that he has Jamaican ancestry, but he's lived in the UK his whole life. And broadly speaking, they then go through describing his optic neuropathy, his auditory nerve neuropathy, and his painful peripheral neuropathy, and all the appropriate investigations that went on through it, including an erroneous diagnosis of Guillain-Barré syndrome because he had a raised CSF protein. They've got some very nice illustrations of a nerve fiber OCT showing loss of retinal fiber there. And broadly speaking, they take us through this very difficult case, and then they get to the stage where they actually start analysing what to do about his nutritional status. And obviously, we can measure some vitamins. We can measure vitamin B12, obviously. But measuring vitamin B2, which is riboflavin, is much more tricky. And the way in which they've tackled that, and I think this is one of the things I took from the paper, is that you can do acyl-carnitine, so plasma acyl-carnitine, and urine organic acid profiles. And in doing these, which should be available at most hospitals, you can deduce essentially the functional level of riboflavin. So you're not measuring riboflavin directly, but because the enzymes require the riboflavin as a cofactor, they can only work if you have enough on board. Now, you also need to be aware that you need to have a fasted sample to be able to do that, but that will give you some measure of riboflavin. And what they did is they found that the riboflavin marker, the acyl-carnitine profile, was abnormal, and as a result, they were able to deduce that there's a relative deficiency of riboflavin. Now, I'm sure most neurologists like me won't have a working understanding of the acyl-carnitine profile and its very many variants, but they produce a very nice sort of series of paragraphs where they discuss the other conditions that can catch you out with this. And obviously one is a condition called multiple acyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase deficiency, or MAD, which we've had a few case reports on because it's a treatable condition which is often quite debilitating, producing a peripheral neuropathy and some proximal weakness. Obviously, that's very different. So if you found the changes in acylcarnitine profile, you wouldn't be fooled by that. Then there are another couple of conditions which I think most of us will know as Brown-Violetto-Van-Leer syndrome or Fazio-Lon syndrome, but now are referred to as riboflavin transporter diseases. And these conditions, again, are really quite difficult. They're different. They present in childhood or early adulthood with bulbar palsy, axial and distal muscle weakness, optic atrophy, and hearing loss. So there's some resonance as to the clinical presentation there. Phil?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's also centered around the issue of nutritional neuropathy, nutritional optic neuropathy as well, and the lessons for that we need to know about more about veganism as well, in a way, because the... Because vegans, of course, do not have access to B12 or riboflavin through the plant diet that they have. It is sourced only from meat and dairy, though might also be available in soils and things containing bacteria. But so there is no available test, you say, for riboflavin either, other than those you've mentioned. So it's going to be important, really, that vegans have supplements for riboflavin as well as B12. So raising awareness of that, I think.
Yeah. And I think... you know, other specific issues about this particular case is that a number of things are in there to catch you out. So you've got raised CSF protein, which makes you think of an inflammatory rather than a dietary phenomenon. You can have peripheral nerve biopsy changes with some degree of inflammation, which again can catch you out. But I think the crucial thing here is that this is such an unusual combination of phenomenon, the painful neuropathy, the optic neuropathy, and the hearing loss, which very, very strongly pushes you towards this. And really the central role of riboflavin. I mean, obviously, they review the literature, and actually there's a very interesting literature, as you refer to, Phil, of different dietary situations. So the original description of Strawn's was in the West Indies with people who had reasonable calorie intake but were otherwise deficient of vitamins. It's occurred in Cuba in essentially the same situation when the Berlin Wall fell down and the Russian imports all disappeared. Similar things had in Eastern Europe and obviously in Japanese prisoners of war. So we've got quite a number of different settings where the same phenomenon occurs. And one of the difficulties is that we tend to try and supplement riboflavin using things like strong vitamin BPC, which actually contains only marginally more than the recommended dose. So the idea is that you should actually really go out of your way to megadose patients with riboflavin if you're going to come across this sort of situation. They also mentioned that there are some genetic variants which actually predispose you to it. But I think once you get to thinking about the genetics, you're well on the way to having the diagnosis in the bag and hopefully the patient on the appropriate treatment. So I think this is a vitamin that's been underappreciated, perhaps partly because it's difficult to measure, but we've been given a window into it, and I think it's something to think about. Have you had any patients with this kind of problem, Phil?
Not that I've recognised, Guy, but I suppose what I've seen is people, you know, if people with nutritional problems and those with a history of the prisoner of war experience some years ago who had these issues over many, many years. I was wondering, actually, if it didn't have this eponym, Strawn syndrome, whether there might be any sort of better name for it. I mean, would you call it Jamaican nutritional optic neuropathy or something like this, but maybe it is better with Strawn syndrome.
We've seen a few cases actually, and these are not patients who have been vegan, but patients with obsessional exclusion diets. I mean, we had one young woman who only ate potatoes, and she would have cereal, one little bowl of cereal every day, and then she took against the cereal and just ate potatoes. And as a result, she developed essentially exactly this syndrome. And, you know, it was very difficult to manage, but it was clearly nutritional. I hadn't appreciated that riboflavin was probably quite such a potent part of her nutritional deficiency. And I think that's what this case adds, I think, is that an appreciation that it's not just all the vitamin Bs, it is very particularly riboflavin on top of everything else.
Yeah.
But I think if we're gonna have eponyms, it would be really helpful if they're all spelt phonetically.
Yeah. And certainly if we're going to have case reports, if they're treatable like this, then we really, really welcome them. So great. Should we move on to this next one, which is Incongruence in FND, Time for Retirement by John Stone from Edinburgh. And this is actually commenting on a case report, which is by Baz Bloom and the team from Nijmegen about functional freezing of gait. So the timing is good because this comes straight after this detailed gait article that we had in the February issue. And this is a subsection of that, really, the functional gait disorders and specifically of understanding of Parkinson's disease gait. So what the Baz Blom's team have identified is a patient who has functional freezing of gait. But more than that, he developed some compensation strategies to try to overcome the freezing of gait, very, very similar to those seen in Parkinson's who develop freezing of gait. So this was the interest of the case. And what they pointed out was that it had both inconsistencies and incongruities. Therefore, these were the reasons why it was likely to be functional. The inconsistencies were that the gait actually improved with support when he held the wall, but did not deteriorate when there was no support when crossing the threshold through a door, for example. That was seen as inconsistent. There were incongruities such that when this patient used crab walking, that is stepping sideways to try to overcome the freezing, he walked relatively fast and rather unlike that seen in Parkinson's disease. And that when he did skating movements, there was no clear forward movement, unlike in Parkinson's disease. So these were seen as incongruities. And John Stone, the doyen of functional disorders, reviewed the paper for us, and he felt that actually it was probably time to put to bed the issue of incongruity, that actually many of the features that were being described in this case were inconsistencies, and that's fine. But incongruity, he felt, was something that we should not be using anymore. The reasons for that is that if we're saying that something is incongruent, for example, with Parkinson's disease, we're saying that we know absolutely everything about Parkinson's disease. Therefore, if we see a sign that doesn't quite match with that, then it's incongruous. But he feels that even teams that do Parkinson's all of the time cannot ever know everything about it, and therefore we shouldn't label it as incongruity until, well, we should never do that. We should also note that incongruity is not future-proof. There are various conditions that have been better understood with time where we realise that, for example, frontal lobe epilepsy presenting with seizures in which the EEG was normal, we're saying, well, that's incongruous with what we know about epilepsy, therefore it's not epilepsy. And yet it turned out to be epilepsy. So it's not future-proof to say it's incongruity just because we think we know everything about that condition. So, John's is sort of editorial, but it's down as neuromythology because he feels that incongruity in functional neurological disorder should no longer be used. It's really a great bit of reading on its own, and it really helps us to understand. And his bottom line is that we should think in terms just of those positive things which allow us to make a diagnosis of functional disorder. And if there are inconsistencies, then that's fine. Hoover side, the inconsistency between what can do voluntarily, what you do automatically, and that actually he felt he could reinterpret a lot of the so-called incongruities in this functional freezing paper as being inconsistencies, and therefore it would be fine. One of the inconsistencies being that the patient didn't have other features of Parkinson's disease like bradykinesia or rigidity or the non-motor features of Parkinson's either. So it's an interesting pair of papers, and I thoroughly recommend reading it and thoroughly take on board John's point about the incongruity no longer really being valid. And what do you feel about it, Gareth?
I think just coming back to the previous, this is reframing something that we think we know about and allowing you to think about it in a critical way. The reality is that, we can't be all-knowing, and it's arrogant to think that we can. But also, I think John's point is that a lot of the time, the functional disease has a lot of consistency about it. The remarkable thing is that actually when people have a functional gait, it's very frequently like another person with a functional gait. And you think to yourself, well, how can that be? You know, it seems extraordinary that people should manifest in the same way if it's being generated, in some sort of complicated psychological way or whatever else. You think, well, why should it be consistent? If someone's got a visual field defect, with a tubular defect, why should it be manifest like that? And actually, it speaks to the fact that it is perhaps a more robust clinical entity than perhaps it's sort of superficially one thinks it might be.
Yeah, because actually, he particularly focuses on the tubular vision, doesn't he? And has a nice diagram of the tubular vision, something that we would say, well, you know, that's defies the laws of physics, or we would say it's non-anatomical. And John says, actually, it's not anatomical any more than, you know, it's just the brain making its prediction. It's no more anatomical than when we sort of make a face out of random shapes and things. That's just our brain making a prediction. It's just the way the brain predicts that it should be tubular rather than cone shaped, and that's just the way the brain works. Yeah. So that's the functional anatomy of the brain working.
Yes, as the John says in the article, your brain has decided that there is a tunnel, so it doesn't matter what it actually sees. And I think that's a really interesting reframing of the whole issue.
Yeah, it is very much about reframing this paper, and I suppose reframing, using these features to explain the diagnosis in a positive way. That's really his call to arms here, and that's the message we're getting from him repeatedly. And I think more and more of us, are doing that routinely.
In our final piece, we thought we'd just touch on one of our regular features, which doesn't perhaps get coverage in this in any of the podcasts particularly, and that is the AFOBEN, the carphology. And AFOBEN obviously is a neurologist there. After discussion, he or possibly she has preferred to maintain their anonymity. I mean, AFOBEN is from a Welsh proverb, AFOBEN bid bond, who would be a leader, let him be a bridge, which is sort of perhaps harking to the fact that this is our bridge between neurology and general medicine or areas in the wider world. And the brief for AFOBEN is to find tidbits to, in essence, pique interest in the neurologist to look over the fence at other specialties and other things that are going on. And, in this coming issue, we've got a selection of different things. In his own inimitable style, he reminds us of the BSE and highlights the fact that there seems to be a development of a chronic wasting disease in deer, which is actually now started in Yellowstone, which obviously for those of us who lived through the BSE crisis in England is a terrifying prospect. He highlights the fact that there's been a special edition of the Lancet, which talks about Parkinson's disease and tries to encourage people to go across. I appreciate Parkinson's disease is very much neurology, but the Lancet is a general journal. So it gets in on that basis. He talks about ultrasound being used to try and make a difference to the blood-brain barrier, or at least demonstrating that it can disrupt the blood-brain barrier, and a rather elegant way to do it. So he always manages to find these little different things which we think about in a different kind of way. Phil?
Yeah, and why is it called carphology? Of course, we know carphology is sort of plucking at the bedclothes in delirium, but the very first issue of Practical Neurology explained this. It was then written by Rajendra, and carphos is straw, such as birds collect to build a nest, and logia is gathering. And so it's really this gathering together of straw, twigs, and wool from other journals, to rather like Minerva does in the BMJ. So it's points of interest from general medical journals in particular that would pique the interest of neurologists. Trying always to include a picture, and this issue is the sort of aerial view of New York or something, I think, that in the shape of a brain.
I think it's an entirely made up city. Before any of our readers get lost.
New York. I know, right. Okay. So I've got a bit of correspondence, Geraint, because last time we talked about extreme delta brush and asked our listeners to send in their answers. Why on earth should it be called extreme delta brush? And the best I could do was that it meant it was extremely rare. Well, we've heard from Nick Cain, who wrote the excellent review in the last issue of Practical Neurology about EEG and encephalitis. He says, you're quite right, they're extremely rare, but in this case, it refers to their extreme size when compared to the neonate's normal sleep pattern. Geraint, can you translate that, please?
I think anyone keen enough to pursue this, or indeed to have listened to this point in the podcast, well done all round. And perhaps we should just sign off at this point without asking them any other questions.
Geraint, what wisdom you bring to this podcast. So thank you, everyone, for listening. We publish regular podcasts focused on the best content of each issue of Practical Neurology. You can subscribe to our podcast on your preferred platform or app using Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. If you enjoy our podcast, please consider leaving a rating and a review, or even a comment, on the Practical Neurology podcast page on Apple Podcasts. And you can find a link to it in the description of this podcast. So thank you very much indeed. Looking forward to joining you again in a few weeks. From the editors of Practical Neurology, Phil Smith, goodbye.
And Geraint Fuller, goodbye.